Today on Against the Grain, satire, irony, and sociodrama. These are tools that activists can and do use in their struggles and campaigns. But what kind of impact can they have, and how is creative protest conceived and formulated? I'm CS. Larry Bogad discusses his new book, Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Political protest can become predictable and cliched. Think of a succession of speakers addressing a crowd at a mass rally, or authorities being confronted with jeers, insults, and cries of shame. But how do we break with cliché? How do we do something that catches elites off guard, that backs them into a corner, that might spur them to do something that discredits them? You may have heard of the Yes Men or Billionaires for Bush, groups that use pranks and other forms of theatrical protest. Well, my guest today has worked as a writer, performer, and strategist with the Yes Men and many other groups, and he also teaches at UC Davis, where he, Larry Bogad, is professor of political performance. The founding director of the Center for Tactical Performance, Larry Bogad is also a playwright and an author. His new book is Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. Larry begins his book with a discussion of the lunch counter sit-ins in the U.S. South in the 1960s. I asked him to remind us of what happened.
The basic setup was, of course, these lunch counters were segregated based on race. They were whites only in many of these popular establishments and department stores. So that was an issue that meant something in daily life and also was so symbolic of the racism and the apartheid of the time. So the civil rights movement, I think, rightly said, this is a very visible target. It's a soft target. I think we can make a big statement by planning an action here and planning an intervention. So that's the sort of background for what they did.
And so a number of people would walk into a place, a market, a lunch counter, and what would they do?
Well, if you picture it this way, I mean, they thought of it as sociodrama. So I'll set it up that way. They used the term sociodrama. So I've broken it up into a three-act structure in the book. Act one, you know, these folks sit down. They're mostly African-American, some white allies. They've chosen how to dress. They're in their Sunday best. Their comportment is also very calm and rehearsed in that sense. And they just wait to be served or ask politely to be served, and they don't deviate from that script in any way. Act two, generally speaking, a large racist white mob that's offended by their very presence and their visible defiance of these laws comes up and starts to bully them, pick on them, even physically abuse them. And it could get very rough, in fact. And the people maintain nonviolent discipline while undergoing that, neither fighting nor fleeing. Act three, the all-white police force shows up. And of course, there's the twist ending where they arrest not the offenders, but the victims of this violence, which, of course, read very predictably in the Deep South, but was a kind of a cruel twist ending that was unsettling in other places, that was the target audience, be it in other parts of the United States or around the world. So the twist ending of the police and the state arresting the wrong people gave it that unsettling, this is not a piece of theater that resolves itself on stage in a satisfying manner. It's agitating. It's unresolved. And I like to think of that as a sort of critical catharsis. There's no catharsis in the stage or in the event. The catharsis will come through action in the street to change the situation.
So the catharsis in theatrical terms is a kind of resolution, a satisfying resolution for the audience, and here there is none.
That's right. And catharsis in the classic sense could be just, it doesn't have to be happy. It could be very sad, but you're like, okay, it's over. You know, the bad guy won or the good guy, okay, we're done. Whew, let's go get a latte. That was a great show. And this was a sociodrama that they created to stir up a great deal of agitation amongst folks who perhaps are on the other side of the country. It doesn't affect them, and now they're going to get a little more involved. Or in the context of the Cold War, it escalated to the point where with very few resources, they created these like spectacles of racist cruelty and the state being on the wrong side, where heads of state were calling the White House, like the French and British heads of state were like, you know, we have a Cold War going on, right? What are you doing over there? You're making us look bad. They're the bad guys. They're the ones who have abused human rights on the other side. And it just always amazes me how they used performance as this kind of crowbar, this very deliberate performance as a force multiplier. They didn't have a lot of resources when they did actions like, of course, there were many other things they did. I'm just focusing on the sit-ins for now. But so it was through this kind of performance they were able to leverage so much more pressure upon the state to intervene, to make policy changes than otherwise. Very savvy.
They use the term sociodrama. You use the term tactical performance. Are they the same terms? Do they mean the same thing?
Well, tactical performance, I coined the phrase for the name of the book and such just because it's a larger category. So sociodrama is this kind of specific, you know, creating a dramatic confrontation that tells the story you want it to tell. And one of the things you're actually predicting your opponent's behavior, so you've set up a scene where they come in and they're the bad guys doing what they do. And tactical performance for me is a broader sort of category that includes that, but it also includes media pranks, you know, all kinds of hoaxes and other kinds of art installations out in the street that are not dependent on the other guy's response. So it's a bigger category, that's all.
And how important to sociodrama and to tactical performance is this anticipation of what your opponent in that scenario will do?
Yeah, I think it's really important. When you have a sort of, I mean, we sometimes use the term enemy. I sometimes prefer opponent or dance partner. Maybe it's your unwilling dance partner. But when you can anticipate their reaction to what you're going to do and incorporate that into the event the way you've staged it in the first place, you get all kinds of advantages. And so this can happen sometimes surprisingly when your opponent is much more powerful than you. Because they have the preponderance of force and violence, et cetera, they've become predictable because it always works. We send in the police and we bash your head. Okay. So then what the civil rights movement, for example, did, they said, we're outnumbered, we're outgunned. How can we create a scene? They're going to step in it. We know exactly what they're going to do. Let's make that as politically costly for them as we can. And I mean, that has informed a lot of actions, including things that are much less dignified and important than the civil rights movement. For example, the clown army that I was a part of long ago. I mean, one aspect of what we were doing is mobilizing a phalanx of clowns who actually were trained in civil disobedience as well as clowning. And it created this kind of dilemma for the state. You know, if we overreact, it's going to look ridiculous. And if we don't, well, now we have this absurdity happening in the streets.
Yeah. And in terms of the civil rights protesters and in the context of many groups that you discuss in this book, you point specifically to the preparation and the discipline, and you contrast their level of these, you know, key factors with the level of preparation or discipline that the opponents might have.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes it's because the opponents are totally disciplined and trained in other things. So the police are certainly trained in how to beat you down, and they're marvelously equipped for it. But that's not the right tool for the job that they're about to have to do. And in the same sense, I do think, especially in examples such as the civil rights movement, you know, the behind-the-scenes training and rehearsal, I've seen it now discussed a bit in some movies really briefly that are just coming out now, the last few years, about the civil rights movement, but it wasn't as much a part of the story before. The fact that the movement said, right, this is sociodrama, this is creative suffering, so we're suffering in this system anyway, we're going to be creative about it, but that means we're going to rehearse, we're going to prepare, and they would take turns taunting each other, screaming at each other, abusing each other in these sort of backstage areas like churches and community centers, so that they wouldn't just have that fight or flight reflex when it happened in real time. So that sense of theatrical rehearsal came in really handy. Like, they were really prepared. And I've read some of the testimonies of some of the great civil rights activists. They said, when it actually was happening, when I was being attacked, it wasn't as frightening as I thought it would be because I'd rehearsed it. I'd prepared it. So that kind of emotional discipline and discipline over one's own emotions actually, in a strange way, creates a greater emotional affect on others.
So tactical performance, this broader category of actions, what do you see as the goal of tactical performance? Is there a way to generalize? Because I know there are many varieties of these kinds of tactics.
Well, it's like social movements need both sides. You need the sort of grassroots action, political organizing, everyday action. And you need that cultural side too. In fact, I think it's great when they're infused with each other. So tactical performance is that cultural aspect of the movement. It's not something totally separate. It's not just doing stuff in a theater that's about a political issue. That's great. But this is working with specific social campaigns and saying, how can we use theatrical skills or artistic skills, performance skills, to raise the level, like to sort of be a voice amplifier. And again, sometimes it's a force multiplier. Sometimes in a direct action campaign, you're also being creative. And that kind of creative direct action can both directly impact the social structure and lead to more movement building and get more people involved because you've told a story creatively while doing your action. So I think for me, the purpose is to be part of the movement and to bring in that creative or artistic side at the service of, not separate from, but totally at the service of the movement.
And what can humor and parody and satire, for example, do to attract new members to a movement that perhaps, you know, everybody chanting the same thing or listening to a succession of speakers at a rally can't?
I think sometimes if it's enjoyable, it's just the time goes by better and you've earned a little bit of respect with this levity. And now people are like, you know what? I went to that action and I thought it was just going to be a chore and I'm a good person and I've done that and I've gone to church essentially. But now it's like, that was a damn good time. I'm coming back. I'm going to bring my friends next time. Also, if it's participatory, that's a whole other level. Not participatory like everyone has to. We're going to put you on the spot and you'll be embarrassed because you're not used to doing that. But if it's open to participation and someone goes ahead and does it and they're like, you know what? I was just part of this bizarre radical costume ball in the streets. And I came and I brought the silly outfit. You know, I was the bad guy and everyone thought it was great. And I was part of this event. That can both, it's like qualitative and quantitative. Quantitatively, I think that's great, even if it's a small action, because somebody's now been empowered to be, you're creative too, you can do this anytime. And I think it raises that level of participation in a way. I think also for veterans, for people who've been doing it a long time, we can face burnout. That's such a problem. If the action you do, at least some of the actions you do are actually just kind of fun, I hope they're effective too, but they're also effective in a different way, that you just had a good time and you've got out some a little bit of stress by doing this kind of absurd action, let's say, or playful action. I think that serves its own purpose too for sustainability. It's permaculture. It's basically, yeah.
Mm-hmm. His name is Larry Bogad. He's professor of political performance at the University of California, Davis, founding director of the Center for Tactical Performance. And we are discussing his new book, Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play, just out from Routledge. So you said the predictability of authorities or the powers that be or the opponents of an action can really be used to the activists, the protesters' advantage. What other vulnerabilities do social movements and artist activists need to examine and to identify in order to, you know, raise the rate of success of their actions?
Wow, that's a great question, CS. I like that. I think one thing is that some events are so heavily staged, you know, these very big, like the Democratic National Convention, Republican National Convention, but other kind of corporate events, et cetera, they're so staged and the dramaturgy of it is so kind of frozen that they're vulnerable to like saying, okay, I get it. I respect it. This is your symbolism. This is your ritual. Cool. I'm reading it. How can we twist this completely around? So sometimes it's hard. Like if the Republican National Convention is totally fortified, you have to find ways to do things on the fringes or perhaps in a completely unexpected place in order to disrupt their narrative. But there are times when it's possible. I could go into one quick example that's mentioned in the book. Some friends I admire very much based in Boston, United for a Fair Economy. They saw some right-wing congressmen were doing an action on the Boston Tea Party Floating Museum. The idea was to dump the tax code into the water, just like the Patriots dumped the tea, because they want to get rid of the progressive taxes and make them flat taxes. So this is like, I get it. It's pretty clever. You know, you guys are like the good old Patriots. We can always question the story of the Tea Party as this heroic story, but okay. But they've made their own symbolism. So as the congressman, Dick Armey, was one of them, are about to dump the tea into into the water after making a speech, all the media are there. Around the boat floats this little rubber dinghy, And there's a man and a woman in it with a little baby doll. And the sign says, working family life raft. And they go underneath the thing and they say, don't sink us with your sales tax. Don't flatten us with your flat tax. And some of his aides immediately, some of these Republican aides start pointing down and going, yes, sink them with the sales tax. Flatten them with the flat tax. Do it now. Obviously, they were plants, right? They had snuck in. Harder to do these days. So they created this moment where they said, we get your ritual, this very conservative political act of theater. And now we've completely twisted it where when you dump your little box, you're going to destroy the working people. And that's what we think you're really doing. So they did push it. The boat, the dinghy, they did deliberately tip over and flounder around. And it was a great media spectacle.
You mean they dropped the tax code intentionally on this raft?
Well, exactly. They're like, we got to stay in character. That's what we do. I don't know what he was thinking, but they said, we got to do this. So I guess, I mean, my point by telling that story is sometimes they also do symbolic actions, but they may not be expecting a symbolic intervention. They might be expecting a typical kind of cliched protest of people with signs saying the same old chants, and they may have a contingency plan for that. But you may be able to do something that's lighter and more creative and flexible, and that can actually change the meaning of the whole thing. Not always possible, but I think that's one of those vulnerabilities.
So are you saying that with this Boston Harbor action, it was important for these activists not to insult or confront the congressman to be oppositional in a very traditional way?
I think in this case, because there was such an opportunity to do something more clever that actually would read in the media, all you have to do, like there's a snapshot. These congressmen are up on the boat and the little working family life raft is below them. It's fabulous. And it has a great sign. And it works. If they had been chanting A, I don't know that it would have done anything to change the success of the event for the Republicans, honestly. B, it might not even have been mentioned because that's cliche. So, I mean, and we don't measure everything only by how much it gets in the corporate media. I think that's only one small thing, but it is one of the things. So if you do something that's quite cliche, it's not attention grabbing anymore. So if they just did that action, it might have been mentioned 7 counter protesters were there, or it might not. So I think that's kind of the bane of our work as activists is falling into cliche. Like it or not, we're doing performance, which is an art form. If you're doing a picket line, that's performance. It's an art form, just like if a poet was doing a boring poem and using the same old bad rhymes, eventually you have to say that poet's not so great. And I think we need to take responsibility, too, when we do these public actions, whether or not we think of it as a performance, it is. So we should make it the best that we can, just to be effective and compelling and to do charismatic action. So I almost think that surprise is the opposite of cliche here. How can we be surprising?
But surprise is difficult, right? I mean, it's so much easier to fall back on cliche, fall back on something we already know and, you know, we've seen other people do. So, I mean, this is a tremendous challenge for maybe people like me who don't think of themselves as particularly creative. So how does tactical performance then appeal to people as opposed to intimidate them?
First of all, so yes, we've bantered for a while before this. You're very creative. So I don't think, you know, and actually, I think some of these actions I think that's a good point. Actually, I should stop and say, you can't ask too much of people. They've been working all day. Now they're going to go to a protest. And yeah, totally. In fact, it's nice to create a container where people can do something simple that's creative and you've kind of set it up if you're the organizer. It is a little disempowering, I would say, to just have the typical thing where there's lots of speakers and everyone else has to be quiet and just cheer when it's their turn, you know, almost like responsive reading in church or something. And so I think there's something great about this. It sounds like it's a big challenge, but it can also make people feel good and like they're part of it. Even if it's literally like bring something that's this color or bring this kind of prop or bring something, a very simple costume around a theme. Something as simple as that, just to bring that out there, and then everyone's doing it. Then when you walk around the protest space, the middle of town or wherever it is, all of a sudden it's this creative space. You're not only occupying the space, you're opening it up for creativity, for radical creativity, right? And so there's a different feeling at this kind of event. I do agree it's a little bit harder, but sometimes if you say, we can't ask that much of people, like come and bring your own, you know, song that you just wrote. I mean, that's a lot. But if you can just say, right, we're having a radical costume ball, the theme is climate change, go. It's interesting to see what people will bring and how much fun they will have seeing everybody else's thing. It's an open space. And I think some of our greatest actions around that kind of Occupy era were occupying the space and then doing something creative with it. It's great to just take over the space, but to show more of kind of like, give us a vision of the world you want to see. You want a world that's more diverse, egalitarian, creative. Everyone has a chance at the mic, you know? So when we go to the old model, there's something a little retrograde about that. Because, like, actually, we're not going to change the world that much. We're going to still have some experts and everyone else listens. You know what I mean? So I think it's worth coming up to the challenge of what's an elegant, simple, creative thing that everyone can plug into.
Another interesting intervention that you describe in this book, the book is Technical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play by my guest Larry Bogad, who teaches at UC Davis and does a whole lot else. In fact, the book is informed by more than a dozen years of experience Larry has had working as a writer, performer, and strategist with groups like the Yes Men, Billionaires for Bush, the Clown Army, the Oil Enforcement Agency, and Reclaim the Streets. So this is an intervention into a staged event, and this event occurred in 2009 in Washington, D.C. at a conference at which a Republican pollster and strategist is about to give a speech laying out strategies for fighting the passage of Obamacare. So what happens there?
First of all, I was really excited about this, and I was just part of brainstorming behind the scenes, for this one. I wasn't one of the performers, I wish. McIntyre is about to get up there. He's their guru. He's the guy who helped stop Hillary's attempt to reform healthcare in the 90s with the, frankly, really quite effective, unfortunately, ads. So he's about to talk to them. Here's how we're going to stop Obamacare. And just as he's getting going and about to start, someone gets up from the audience and starts singing his praises to the tune of Tomorrow from the popular musical Annie. So it's that very familiar song that we all know. And she's singing, for killing the public option and crushing any hopes of its adoption. Thank you, sir. So here's this moment. Sorry for singing there. I apologize to the listeners. But literally, like, it's a moment where everyone's like, what's happening? Because it's not a protest. She likes him. But is she just some one of us who just loves him so much? I mean, well, he did save us a lot of money. Like, you just can imagine what's going on in their heads, and it throws it off in this bizarre way. The next singer who stands up from the other side of the room is the counter. You know, every song has the voice and counter voice, and here comes the counter voice saying, wait a minute, and is arguing that the public option is good and we should definitely reform healthcare.
This is all in song.
This is all in song. It all rhymes. You can see the link on my site, by the way, and just watch the video, and you don't have to hear me singing, thank God. But basically, one person after another gets up, and they're singing this wonderful, and it builds and it builds, and eventually there's like 5-6 singers. So you can imagine people in this corporate conference going, am I the only non-singer? Is everyone else going to sing? Am I part of this? And it's this guerrilla musical that disrupts the event in this super playful way. I was really happy with the result. I think a lot of us were, because it then is aired on major cable news networks, and it goes viral, et cetera, on the internet, because it's such admittedly bizarre, but it has the content in it. The bizarreness and the playfulness and the critical content are infused in each other. If you cover this story, you're going to cover our point of view. So it doesn't just get lost in that sense. And so I thought it was fun. And this was at the same time that on the other side, people in the Tea Party, like the death panel people, their protests were very ugly and sometimes even violent. And so our tone was deliberately playful and surprising and creative to show that contrast as well.
And why not an original song instead of a song put to a popular tune? And also, why have the first singer sing the praises of this man?
Oh, my God. So singing the praises, this was probably my only contribution to the project worth giving, was I said, I really think it's a holy, sacred moment when people have infiltrated this event in their nice suits and ties and dresses, and they have no idea what's going to happen. The first person who stands up has got to be singing his praises. Again, the sacred, weird moment where it's not clear what this is. And I think it throws things off in a really nice way. There's this synaptic disruption. Everyone's synaptic network is stimulated. Like, what's happening? I don't know. As opposed to a cliche, you get up there and you say, start insulting the guy. The security comes right in. In fact, the security didn't react fast enough to end the song. The song finished just as they were being ushered out because of this kind of fake out. And so I thought that was like, I always want to say, like, what's the cliche thing for us to do? Okay, what's the next idea? And so to just start with that wonderful affirmation really gave the whole thing this wonderful tone, even though our criticism was totally in it, you know? And then why use, okay, so, I mean, it was sad. Why use the song from Annie? Someone had actually written an original song for this intervention in secret. He's a wonderful musical writer. And at some point, a day or two before, I think the group realized, hey, this is great, but if we do a song that everyone on the planet knows pretty much, or everyone in America knows, and just change the lyrics, it's going to work better. Sorry. Let's use that song for something else. Because, and that's a long old tradition, right? The Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world, would take old church songs and old folk tunes and make them about anarcho-syndicalism. Yay. You know. So here we are as this group, just following in that time-honored tradition. Like, if people know the tune, they have more energy to listen to the words too. Either it's more fun, it's more interesting because they know the tune, but the lyrics pop out more because they're not also learning a new tune.
And some people at this event never reveal themselves as activists. Why?
Super important. Plain clothes pranksters. You know, you got your pranksters. We got to have plain clothes pranksters. And those folks basically are like, oh, this is so strange. I'm one of you guys. I think it's weird too. You know, and then are taping it on their phones. Why? So then later when the whole people have been cleared out, they just excuse themselves quietly, you know, just going to the bathroom, whatever. And then everyone just runs, edits the little video clips together. And that way you can safely, because by the way, they're not going to document your event for you. When we say become the media, don't criticize the media, become the media. This was an example. Like, we got to get our own footage from the angles we want, edit it wonderfully. And then you're doing people's work for them. So when you send it to Rachel Maddow, when you send it to Wolf Blitzer, maybe they're tired that day. Maybe they find it interesting, I hope, for their quirky news section or whatever. But also that you've already given them something where they can just play it and make a little running commentary. So it got major play, I think, partly because we'd given them this easy to use, kind of fun piece.
And nothing like something amusing, as you point out in this book, to get past the gatekeepers, the media gatekeepers.
I think so. I think if you entertain them, you're halfway there. You know, we've all had this result, like as activists, you do something and maybe a well-meaning reporter interviews you or covers it, but it's got to get past the editor and then it's got to get past the producer or whoever on the TV news. You know, they're thinking about the advertisers. So there's a lot of barriers, and that's why we want to make our own media as well, of course, or come to KPFA. But part of it is being a little charismatic in general. It always pays off. You can get around a lot if what you're doing is very compelling or charismatic in that way. It doesn't always have to be playful. Doesn't always have to be funny. I find that's one of the great ways. You can also just create an action that's so compelling on the other side, very somber, but symbolically powerful.
Larry Bogad is my guest in studio. He is author of Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. He's also the author of Electoral Guerrilla Theater, Radical Ridicule and Social Movements, which is now in its second edition, and of a number of plays, including COINTELSHOW, A Patriot Act, Haymarket, Tahrir, and Econo-Music, Keeping Score. And he's a rabble-rouser, a strategist, and a performer with most of the groups he talks about in this book, Tactical Performance. We'll take a short break and speak more with Larry. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Larry Bogad teaches political performance at the University of California, Davis. He's a professor there. And we are discussing his new book, Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. We have a link to that book as well as to his website on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, speaking of somber scenarios and actions not designed to, you know, make people laugh or anything, but to make people think, certainly, and to create, as you write, an irresistible image that even one's ideological opponents may find themselves publicizing and sharing. And and distributing to their ultimate disadvantage, one would think. There is a group called, well, there is an initiative called 1,000 Coffins. It was formed in response to the U.S. government's ban on the filming of the coffins of dead U.S. soldiers returning home from Iraq. So how did 1,000 Coffins contest this ban outside the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York City?
Yeah, that's a good one, C.S. It's pretty classic, I think, at this point. You know why the Bush administration banned the image of the flag-covered coffins. It's an image that doesn't serve them politically. Constitutionally, probably not constitutional, and people were pursuing it in court, but that takes forever. So what this group did is they said, okay, we're not allowed to show those photos of this important image, so let's create the image. We will perform the censored image. And they made 1,000 cardboard coffins, covered them with flags, and marched them through the streets of New York. So this was an image that ended up on the front page of many newspapers, major newspapers, even conservative ones, because it's such a strong, irresistible image. And I think it's hard to do that. It's hard to conceive of that. But when you can, sometimes you know that it's one of those. It is eloquent. You either show it or you don't. If you show the image, it tells your story. And I'm amazed by that. That's hard to conceive of sometimes. You don't need a full half-hour coverage on the news to explain what you're doing there. So it's charismatic and eloquent while being totally somber. And I think that's important. We need to have the whole emotional palette as options that we're choosing from. Not always clowny and funny. I gravitate towards that, but that's only one side of it. And 1,000 Coffins was great. They also politically were savvy and started to work with progressive veterans groups who gave them legitimacy, also gave them the ability to march more in rank and file in a more organized way. And it was those groups that said, hey, we need to represent the Iraqi casualties and the Afghani casualties with these flags. We need to change some of the flags and do that, which was, of course, profound and good improvement. And then with that coalition, they went to D.C. and they made installations that were quite gripping right there in front of, the major monuments down in D.C. of these huge, vast expanses of coffins covered in flags. So, yeah, it was a powerful image and, again, an example of it don't have to be funny. It just has to really be thinking about the interventions into the symbolic terrain.
Was the action only about protesting the war?
I'm glad you asked that because as the people who participated in said, it's like, look, we're protesting, but we do want to have some kind of funereal and reverent thoughts for the dead. And we're not just being against the state, et cetera. And we want to show respect for those who have lost their lives in the sense. And that's powerful. And I think it enables people to make coalitions across your own identity. If you're the quote unquote typical protester, none of us likes that phrase, but it's a phrase that is said, right? If you're someone who already is a veteran of social movements in a sense, it's wonderful to reach out to a veteran's family and say, right, we're on the same side, and through performance, I think performance is uniquely equipped to create coalitions across borders of identity or ideology because our bodies are performing that coalition in the moment. We're in the street together doing this action, right? We're performing our solidarity and our coalition. So I think that's good within a group that already exists, like a labor union. But I think, let's say, if you have gay rights activists and labor activists together realizing that they should both put, and they're both in the street doing something creative together, it's powerful for people outside who are watching and experiencing it. I think it's powerful within the group to say, we are actually consecrating our solidarity through this. And I think 1,000 Coffins was an example of that. Different kinds of people working together and creating this event.
You were also at an event in Alameda, California in 2009. So this was a town hall held by a congressperson who supported the passing of the Affordable Health Care Act, aka Obamacare. Tea Party activists were on hand. And what were they doing?
They were doing what they were doing a lot of at that time, which these really huge signs that were pretty hardcore. And I admired how big their signs were. I was like, you can read this from the highway. I got to tell my people, we got to make bigger signs. It's very important. Tell my students to make bigger signs. But big signs that were really harsh language about communism and death panels and all this sort of thing. And they were very, they were very strong. They're very hardcore and shouting at people and kind of demonizing people using that rhetoric. And you know what? For their relatively small numbers, pretty effective in what they were trying to do. I got to give it to them. because they had become predictable, though, again, don't be predictable, folks, unless you're on the other side, then please stay predictable. We said, all right, what can we do? And some dear friends, Mark Pinate, Ari Eshel, and others, including myself, the idea was, what can we do that would confound this tactic? What's the counter tactic? And we rehearsed a bit. We showed up as the ghosts of each one of us was the ghost of a real, factual, individual person that was basically killed by corporate healthcare, by the system we had before. Well, it continues, but, you know, the pre-Obamacare system. So specifically examples of people who paid their premiums, and when it came time to need help, they were denied, you know, and they died. And so this is awful, but our action was to try to honor their memory and put that in the face of these folks' pretty hateful rhetoric and extreme rhetoric. And it was something they didn't have a good answer for. So imagine a lot of people that are made up like abstract ghosts. We weren't trying to be haunted house, like absurd ghosts, by the way. It was kind of just eerie. It was more of an eerie affect. And we had signs on us of the person we were representing. And very respectfully, not directly engaging them, we would just go up to them and just very quietly say our stories, like a ghost that's haunting them. And people could hear it. It was loud enough for people to hear. Sometimes we all moved together at the same time. We had to kind of rehearse where we would all flinch in a way that suggested the disease that had killed us or the ailment, which is pretty awful to see, actually. It was creepy. And so they proceeded to do their thing, yell at us, call us communists, who want the government to take over everything, you know, doing their rhetoric. And at some point, they realized, wait a minute. They had that moment of, we're shouting at the dead. Symbolically, we look terrible right now. And they went away. They actually walked away. So we followed them. We were like, great. And we just haunted them the whole action. And it took the wind out of their sails. And in fact, there's a video of this online. One of them at the end, I'm so glad someone caught it on camera, came up to us and said, you know what? I don't agree with you guys, but that was really good theater. And it's like, good. I appreciate that. We can talk to each other as people. But again, the takeaway from that for me is, seeing and respecting the other side enough to pay enough attention to think of, okay, what's the real counter tactic? If I go up and just scream at them, okay, that might make me feel better, but that's what they're totally excited about. So I think it's better to outflank them conceptually. Recently in Helsinki and other times in the American South, there have been far right events. Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis. In Helsinki, it was the Soldiers of Odin. And what happened in all these events is clown people showed up and just mocked them and just punked them as clowns. And in every example, there was no real good counter tactic. It's just showing, and it's not trivializing, it's showing we're not afraid of you and we're trivializing you, you know? And so that's, for me, that's that kind of counter tactic.
Larry Bogad is his name. He also goes by L.M. Bogad, which you'll see as the author of the book Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play by my guest. It's recently out from Routledge, and the book draws from Larry's own experiences in fieldwork, creative practice, and political activism. He's professor of political performance at the University of California, Davis, and he's the founding director of the Center for Tactical Performance. So another thing you bring up in this book that I find very intriguing and important is that you argue that civil disobedience and radical performance have the potential to model citizenship. What does that mean?
Well, I think in this kind of neoliberal age, citizenship is often defined by, okay, you commute, you consume, you know, you work, you buy things. And occasionally when we ask you to, you vote for these wonderful choices. So this constricted idea of citizenship, I think, is it grinds away at folks generation after generation. And it's so interesting. The students that I teach sometimes, when they some of them come ready to go, and some of them come to the class like, can we really do this? Can we go and do something in public space? Like, yes, you can. In fact, this freedom is a use it or lose it proposition. Let's go out and use that muscle before we totally lose it. So I think that modeling of citizenship, in a sense, like, wow, they did that action. They did that media hoax or prank or just took the street, you know, and did something creative around their issue. I think it is. I think it's modeling a different kinds of behavior than just the sort of more complacent or the constricted sense that I think we're taught is what citizenship is about.
And also, you mentioned this in your book, it's a way of helping people to reimagine conduct and behavior in public space.
Yeah, absolutely. We are, in some ways, America likes to say it's the freest country in the world, et cetera. And it's so incredibly restricted, both literally, like there's a lot of rules about what you can or can't do in public space, but also just culturally. I think it's pretty restrictive. And so to have us imagine a world where public space is actually a place for creativity, not just for selling things, you know, is, I think, a wonderful act in and of itself. And I think actions like Reclaim the Streets actions in the past were like that. I think that critical mass actions are like that, specifically about bicycles, but they're also very creative. They can be, right? And I think, therefore, it's important that the images that you put out, depending on the culture you're operating in, I think it's great to create something that really is open and invites participation to your creative protest if you can. I was doing a workshop in Iceland shortly before everything collapsed with some eco-anarchist folks who had brought me over, and it was a blast. They were really amazing. The creative imagery, I almost want to joke that they're very Viking influenced, because the imagery of a lot of their things when they got creative was like, we're going to hang this effigy of this guy, or, okay, here's the face of that politician, throw darts, and they're inviting people to throw darts at the face. I get it, guys, but this is pretty Viking. you know, like, what can we do that's going to get people to join in who aren't into that, you know, and who aren't about that, even as a metaphor, you know, because it was, they were being playful, they're not actually hurting anyone, but still, like, what are the metaphors where we can get folks in on this movement and get some momentum? So that's sometimes the challenge too. So offer different kinds of citizenship and then meet people halfway too.
Now, I'm sure this has happened to you where you come up with a tactic and you fall in love with it. I mean, it works, it's catchy, it's irresistible, it creates media attention, and you think, wow, I'm just gonna keep doing this, right? Because it works. So what do you think about this, you know, this idea or this reality of people falling in love with a tactic and just saying, I'm going to keep pounding it because I enjoy it and it's working?
Yeah, totally. That's a great one, because as I was saying, like, you know, the apartheid regime of the South in the United States was outflanked because they were predictable. So what about little old us, the social movements? If we become predictable, that's just like, unpredictability is one of our great cards we can play if we have it going. So I think if we do become predictable, even for that understandable reason, like, oh, that was fun, let's do it again. I mean, I've been part of actions, my fault. Like, I own up. Like, I was like, wow, I can't believe we thought we could just do the exact same thing twice and they wouldn't have learned. This is what tactical interaction is. So, you know, as the oil enforcement agency, we totally disrupted the Los Angeles Auto Show as this fake agency that was like quoting President Bush in his State of the Union address when he said America's addicted to oil. So we said, okay, America's addicted to oil. Well, let's be his agency. We're supporting Bush. So we showed up in uniforms and we totally disrupted this thing. All the big SUVs and all the big wasteful cars. We actually made a climate chaos crime scene tape around and said, everyone, please stay away. These cars are very dangerous for America. Thank you, ma'am. Thanks for your cooperation. We did this whole thing and they didn't expect it. So that was wonderful and it was fun. And then we tried to do the exact same thing in Detroit. Now, come on. These guys have private detectives. They have all the whole Detroit police, and they were not going to let us do the exact same thing again. But okay, that's how we learned. You know, we fell in love with that tactic. I mean, it's in the same sense like the older tactics, such as, you know, the first regular demonstration ever in the world where thousands of regular people got out in the streets with signs must have been electrifying. Oh my God, everyone's out. Mm. Holy cow. And they have signs that say, whoa, you know. And then you have to change it up a little a century and a half later, you know. So all respect, and in the same sense, the same old chants. We used to try to come up with new chants and even Dada anti-chants, because when you hear someone say, hey, hey, ho, ho, blah, blah, blah has got to go, you know, we've all been there. We've all done that chant. But eventually we started to say, hey, hey, ho, ho, hey, hey, ho, ho has got to go. Just trying to get people to just even that in that small example, say, let's change it up. But it's very hard, because when you have a good tactic and it's fun, now it's very seductive.
And so, Larry, it's clear that you have, you know, some reservations about kind of the mass conventional demonstration where you have this march and everybody's chanting the same thing. And then you get together at a certain point, you convene and you listen to a succession of speakers. What about a demonstration that would involve, say, blocking a bridge or bringing mass transit to a halt in an effort to call attention to some injustice, whether it might be like a war abroad or police brutality at home?
I think it's amazing, and it can be a really great way to raise the stakes. And it's also a performance of commitment. I think sometimes the way in which those actions operate is people showing, this is unacceptable, and we're not just paying a price, we're showing the world that we're willing to pay a price of punishment for this action. So it can be very eloquent. I think it's even better when it's about what it's about. In other words, the thing that you're blocking is something that is both symbolically and practically tied to what you're protesting. Maybe sometimes that's not possible or it's not a thing. So you block the bridge, but it's about the war. But if there's something that's directly connected to the war that you can blockade, and ideally blockade with creative elements, you know, blockade with symbolic props, costumes, music, that tells your story even more. You know, connect the dots for the viewer, essentially.
Because if they don't get it, if the message isn't clear, then...
Well, then you're just making their commute home impossible. And I know there's more to it than that, but I know some folks are going to be kind of alienated by it and not get the point. And again, I understand sometimes that's exactly what needs to be done. But I think it's really amazing when someone says, right, this is the place. This is the police headquarters, which happened in Oakland a while ago. We're going to blockade civil disobedience at the police headquarters. Well, that's pretty clear storytelling and impressive, you know. But it could be the shipyard where the material that's coming in that you don't want to come in is being blockaded. So that's just, you know, it's not a supremely complicated thing, but it's just like making your action about what it's about.
So, you know, we've been talking a lot about tactics, and there's also this thing called strategy, and there's also this thing called goals. So can you make a distinction between strategy and tactics if that's important? And also, how important is it for one's goals to be established and defined before tactics are created?
I mean, I think ideally, first of all, to me, the distinction is, you know, strategy is the overall overarching way that you're going to get what you want. And then the tactics are the individual tools that you implement to get there. So like when we were talking about the civil rights movement, okay, the sit-in was a tactic. It wasn't a strategy. The strategy involved the legal aspect, civil disobedience, you know, lobbying, fundraising, you know, working through the churches, all kinds of things that they did. And all of it was to break down that apartheid structure and do a lot of other things too, hopefully for human rights in the country, all around the country. So yeah, I think it's pretty important. I do think sometimes the goals get determined through dialogue in movements. So sometimes as a big movement, we don't have the goal all set out because we don't have a centralized power structure. And maybe that's a good thing. You know, you don't have one dictator in the movement who says what's to happen. So sometimes the goals are formed through praxis. We basically know we want to work really hard on climate change, climate disaster, climate chaos. Okay, and then we're trying to figure out what are the pressure points, you know? What are the pressure points in the body politic that we can press on, like acupressure? I think of it as radical acupressure, right? So we have a basic goal, and then different groups in the movement try different tactics, hopefully in dialogue with each other, not upstaging each other, to use a theatrical term, not messing each other up. So I think it's important for groups to talk to each other. I think the idea of overarching strategy is often being revised as we go. And I think that's okay because we have to learn from each other's mistakes and successes too, as far as how are we going to get there? How are we going to get the U.S. to finally deal with climate disaster?
Well, speaking of success, you know, isn't there a problem sometimes, many times, of trying to figure out whether a creative action has been effective, has had the desired impact?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes after a campaign, I'm like, okay, how many widgets of social change did we produce today? 3.7. You know? So that, it's tricky. It's hard to evaluate. I mean, if you have the kind of action where you're like, right, we're going to get Citicorp to divest from this horrible environmentally destructive stuff they're doing in Ecuador, you know, or Colombia. Well, sometimes then you can really like, okay, they did. We cost them money. A lot of people took their stuff, money out of the bank, and they changed their policy. So sometimes it's really specific like that. When it's something larger, hopefully you're part of the movement that makes things change. And sometimes I think you just have to keep pushing. It's a lifestyle choice, yes. Mm-hmm. It's a lifestyle choice.
It is.
Because even when you win, like this wonderful victory against Chevron's paid candidates in Richmond in the election that municipal election where we were all like, oh my goodness, every one of their guys lost. The Progressive Coalition won. You know, there was a lot that went into that. Could you isolate any one activist action, including street theater, let's say, and say, well, that was 0.0%, 1% of the thing? I don't know. I think it's more part of putting your shoulder to the wheel and like pushing, you know, and having a lot of different kinds of tactics. So it is frustrating, though. As a social science researcher, it's like, how can you prove that you did your share? It's hard to quantify it.
Yeah. I mean, frankly, sometimes, you know, when I talk with activists, you know, they want to think they're making a difference, right? So they're going to interpret their actions and the result of their actions in a certain way that makes them feel good. They don't want to, you know, drown in despair, and they don't want to maybe articulate a lot of doubts about whether this or that intervention was successful. So in some ways, I wonder how objective one could be evaluating an action. Because, you know, maybe, yeah, the people participating in it have one view. The people, you know, their opponents or ideological enemies might have another. How do we really get to the truth?
For sure. I mean, one thing's for sure is I think that debriefing session after an action is super important. It's such a big part of praxis. So we went out there. First of all, it could be a serious action and something with dignity. But in my case, more likely, it's not. And it's like, we went out there with our big shoes and our clown. We totally confused the police and the thing. But then let's do a meeting afterwards to see what the heck that accomplished. Like, so I think it's great to be self-critical after an action. And yeah, not to be despairing and overly it's hard enough to be an activist, right? So but to be honest in a group and say, how did that go? And just to frame it more positively, like, how could we make it better next time, straight up? And I do that in my classes, right? So my students will do an action and I'm like, that was an excellent experiment, you know? And how could you improve it next time?
His name is Larry Bogad. His website is larrybogad, that's BOGAD.com. He is professor of political performance at UC Davis. And his new book is Tactical Performance, The Theory and Practice of Serious Play. It's out from Routledge. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Larry, thanks so much for coming on our program again and sharing your insights with us.
C.S., thank you so much. This was a pleasure, and thanks for all the great provocative questions.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.